Welcome to the Rooted in Change podcast.
Hey everyone, my name is Jan and you're listening to the Rooted in Change podcast. This show features European clean tech champions and their solutions to tackle the climate crisis. Today's guest is Frederik, founder and CEO at Treyatech. Sustainability is obviously at the core of this podcast. Often the founders who join me on this show propose great solutions to reshape products or how industries work. And oftentimes it focuses on the input of a process, for example, on novel materials for batteries or construction. Treyatech is also there to rethink an industry, but they follow a different approach. Frederik and his team have developed a technology that converts a broad range of waste streams into reusable resources. A fascinating industry. Looking forward to learning more. Welcome, Frederik.
Hi, Anne. Thank you for having me.
I always ask my guests as the first question, what's your background? Who is a person? So maybe if you want to introduce yourself, who are you?
Sure. So, I was born in Switzerland. I'm 40 years old now. And I have a background of a life science engineer. I graduated from a school nearby my place called EPFL. And that's my background.
Right. And then, you know, I had a number of conversations now with people who studied at EPFL. I think, you know, probably one of the most successful and leading universities in Switzerland, institutes in Switzerland for sort of technology that also has climate applications. I obviously mentioned in my intro that, you know, waste is a huge, huge problem. But what sort of sparked your interest, or how did you end up founding Treyatech? What's the journey there for you?
So of course it's a good question, because what we do at Treyatech is quite far from my background. And
yeah, exactly. Especially sort of where, you know, where you started your studies.
Exactly. So I really love my studies. I finished my master thesis in UC Berkeley, where I had the chance to nice. To feel a little bit this feeling of the Silicon Valley and entrepreneurship, and this was always something that was inside me that I didn't dare really, but I wanted to do something. Like I was very excited about innovation. I really wanted to do something that could be important, insightful for the world. And right after my studies, when I came back to Switzerland, basically the main message from the industry was, oh, you need to do a PhD now. And
right, that's sort of the standard next step.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. In life science, it's. I mean, I was really part of the first generation of this specific faculty. And yeah, the industry was not ready to really capitalize on our background. So most of my colleagues did a PhD and got some specialization. I was already very tired after a lot of time at EPFL, and PhD was not really for me. So, you know, I worked a little bit here and there to make sure that I could leave. And at the same time, I was very interesting with waste and with energy. And I felt like there was really something to do about it. And I started, it's really like the very typical startup story. So I started with a friend of mine. We were using the basement of another friend of us, and we started to do pyrolysis. So basically the conversion of wood chips and wood waste into a liquid fuel, and, you know, designing, crafting some small prototypes, which...
Was that just for fun, or was it sort of what sparked that process? Because obviously, like, you're right that this is how many great... startup stories start, that, you know, it's a garage somewhere, or it's the backyard, and you know, either you find the technology, or, you know, either you worked in a lab and out of a sudden it works. But compared to where you started with your life science background, you know, that journey of, you know, doing that work in a basement somewhere, it's not straightforward. So what's sort of what sparked that interest, or sparked that journey?
It was a little bit for fun, but there was always the idea of, okay, how can we, like, leave at some point from this very fun activity.
Right. And so maybe that's exactly that impact that Berkeley and the Valley had on you, that entrepreneurial mindset was there, right?
Of course, mm-hmm. Of course, which is very different from the typical Swiss mindset, I would say, especially in terms of risk-taking, etc. And before we decided to go with Paralysis, actually something that was very closer to my background was that we had the idea of using microalgae to produce biodiesel. And this is really about tricking microalgae or microorganism DNA, etc., which was really something that was part of my background. And then when we read about the literature and where the industry was standing, we did like initial budgets of how much it would require to build like first like small batch, we said, okay, it's going to be too expensive. We cannot afford that. Maybe there is something like different that we can do. And that's how we came to the Paralysis, and we're going to the sawmill very close to our place and taking some stuff and, you know, making a lot of smoke in this basement. And, you know, eventually it worked. Like we could replicate a little bit what people did already in the 40s or in the 50s. And that's the moment where we realized, okay, unless you have something like new, you need innovation, you need IP, you need like, you cannot just like, it's a complex industry, the clean tech, etc. People will not buy from you just because you're greener or you can do something like more healthy for the environment, especially because it's usually more expensive. So,
right. So that idea of the green premium, right? That
absolutely
worked for a long time, where people said, you know, because it's green, because it's more sustainable, I'm willing to pay slightly more. I think that has totally shifted today.
Of course,
good
of course.
That you saw that earlier.
Which was something a bit more present back in the days, because here I'm talking like 2012, 2013, you know.
Right.
And at this moment, you could sell just green. You could sell green. Today, you need to sell something that is cheaper. And then if it's green, then it's a nice to have thing, is the cherry on the cake. We decided at this moment, okay, we should go back to the academia and discuss with these guys and see like, is there any match with something else in terms of innovation? And that's where I went back. I started to work with a professor at EPFL that was interested with the specific reactors that we designed for this Paralysis process. And the guy told me that he just patented a very similar reactor, but not for solid wastes, mostly for liquid effluents, something that under specific conditions can actually remove the minerals from a specific liquid waste streams, such as metals, ashes, minerals, different things. And I was like, okay, great. There is an IP here. There is a patent. So that's beautiful. How much am I going to fight to be the chosen person to work on this patent? And well, you know, that's how academic works. Like you have these PhD people and these guys, they want to dig and continue digging. And eventually I was a bit the only one who was really interested in trying to valorize a patent. It's not because you have a patent that you're going to make millions or that you're going to sell it very quickly to someone. So I said, okay, let's start with this. I had some very great support around me, like friends, families, friends from my network who like, you know, had a little bit of this entrepreneurship fiber who, you know, helped me to get the first funding, because this IP was really funded based on numerical simulations. And then from the computer, we needed to go with the right first prototypes, which we
needed to prove it in practice, right?
Of course, absolutely. And this required a small budget, like 400,000 Swiss francs. That's what I was looking for back in the days, $400,000, let's say. And it took me like a very long time to find this. When you have a patent, you feel like, oh, like public grants are going to flow, you know, and we're going to get a lot of money. But no, eventually it was very more complex than that. And the first guy who helped me and said like, okay, I'm going to give you a bit of money, but you need to find someone else because you are going into an industry where you will need a lot of capital in the future. And this guy, he's named Jean-Jacques Mioton. He's a very successful entrepreneur, friend of my dad, actually, that I met like Dives, and he's part of a family business, and he's always very excited to support young entrepreneurs. And he opened to me his network, and I had the chance to pitch this project to the CEO of Philip Morris International,
right?
Which of course is a tobacco company, but their headquarters are based in Lausanne, and they are interested in like supporting local companies. Luckily for me, they were just about to create their innovation fund, and I was the first project that got some funding. So that was great. We had not much, huh? We didn't have much, but we have external investors. So I had to create a company, you know, to secure some collaterals for these guys, etc., to make a license agreement with the IP from EPFL. And more importantly, I had to find a team because, again, now I was a bit entering into the chemical engineering more than life science. So, and yeah, this took me like quite some time to find my first associate, co-founder and CTO, who is still our CTO today, Gail. And Gail was actually working on the next step of this initial IP we had from EPFL. So once you have a reactor that can remove the minerals, you need to have something else that will eliminate the organic fraction from the waste. And
right,
these guys, they spent like two decades in the lab, and Gail is really one of the dad of this technology. Mm. He was developing specific catalysts that would right. break all these organic molecules from a liquid effluent into renewable gas. And, you know, that's how these two IP, because he did his PhD at another institute in Switzerland called Paul Scherrer Institute, where these guys had a great know-how on the heterogeneous catalysis. And it's a bit like this combination between EPFL and this institute. And Gail joined me. Then suddenly the public funding we got a bit luckier. So we got some grants and able to build a small team and build this first equipment. And we really, that was 2015, 2016. And we spent almost until COVID, so 2019, 2020, we spent our time at EPFL in the chemical faculty. We were hosted by a professor that was supportive and interested with the technology, and you know, building first prototypes and working specifically on municipal sewage sludge, which is the residue collected in wastewater treatment plants.
Yeah.
We have some. When you deal with waste, the regulatory framework is very important.
Yeah.
And in Switzerland, the sewer sludge is something that cannot be landfilled or land spread on the field by farmers. It has to be incinerated. So it's first very costly. And when you incinerate such type of feedstock, you eventually lose the minerals that you have there. And sewer sludge is a great fertilizer. It contains a lot of ammonia, potassium, phosphorus. Something
that's really at the core of your technology, right? Because we haven't really covered that, but let me summarize that from the outset. Ultimately, you take such a value stream, or you know, waste, and you're able to extract those elements that you just mentioned, so potassium and others. And with the second part of the IP that you described before, you're able to turn sort of the organic components into gas that is then being fed into applications, grid.
Yes. So our process allows to eliminate specific liquid waste streams, so waste that contains quite a lot of water.
Yep.
And when you deal with waste, water is actually always an issue. You want to dehydrate your waste as much as you can, especially if it goes for incineration after that. So our process really has this great advantage that water is not an issue anymore. It's actually essential for the good process. So we eliminate this waste, and by doing so, we can first recover this mineral fraction that sometimes you can valorize for phosphorus, potassium, such things can be really further valorized as fertilizers. And then we produce renewable gas from the organic fraction. And what is very important is that the main element that goes into a process is water. And this is also the main element going outside from its main outcome. And again, when you go for incineration, this water is evaporated and lost as steam. So in a lot of countries, I think water is not worth a lot, but there are some countries where the pressure on water is really increasing, and it's very important to be able to recover a clean water. That's very important, is that the water that comes outside from our process is industrial grade water, can be used in the agriculture or by the industrial people, could be drinkable water at some point, but we need further purification, of course.
Which I guess also depends on the local laws, right? And I think it's interesting what you mentioned there, that you know the waste before, because of regulation, because of how it's treated, is normally incinerated, which also needs energy, right? So sort of you take a resource stream, you put more resources towards it, and then more or less everything disappears and also creates emissions. Whereas with your approach, it's really circular. You're able to retrieve the elements, you're able to create renewable gas, and you purify the water, which then can be fed into the process. It's a really cool approach to how to treat waste differently.
Exactly. Yeah, the fact that we don't need to evaporate, really, because we work with these specific conditions of pressure and temperature. But this actually allows us to produce energy instead of consuming natural gas to dispose this waste. And obviously, when you burn water, you need a lot of energy, and in terms of CO2 emission, this has like pretty big impact. So yeah, that's really one of the cool things from this solution.
Nice. And then we sort of stopped your the history of Treatech around COVID. So how far have you come then since then, over the last 5 years?
Yes, so obviously COVID didn't help really, but just before COVID, we actually joined forces with Gail's former boss at this Paul Scherrer Institute, and we got some funding from the Swiss Federal Office of Energy. That was a great support for us. And this funding was really dedicated for the scale. So in the lab, just to give you an idea, we were working with prototypes with throughput of 1 kilogram per hour. And we created these first pilots, which was able to deal with 100 kilogram per hour. So we built and designed and commissioned together with PSI and some other suppliers and stakeholders some supports. And this was operated for a little bit of time in 2021-2022. At this moment, we also got some grants from the European Commission that really allowed us to build a team, because before that, we were just the three co-founders that we are today. The third one is our colleague, Raquel, also a chemical engineer, our CEO today. And this grant that we got in 2020 really allowed us to build a team. We were maybe 7 or 10 at the end of 2022. And, it was a bit the moment where we felt like, okay, academia, we have done what we were supposed to
right.
do. And then now it's time that we fly with our own wings and go a bit to the real world.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and how does that look now? I mean, I think that's the really interesting part that a lot of founders share. And, I think this is where your journey is also interesting, because it's so different from what most other founders do, where normally they do their PhD. You described this very, very well in the beginning, why this wasn't for you. But then during their PhD, they discover something, they discover a process, or, in your case, what the professor did with the patent, they do that on their own. And then sort of they stay in academia for maybe slightly longer, and then at one point it's time to go out in the real world, so to say. Not to say that academia is real world, but I guess it's different from, or building a company, or at least it's different from, doing your research. And oftentimes I think this is where it's really hard, because what you did sort of on a lab scale and proved that it works on a lab scale works really well. And you mentioned this before, that you had to prove it. Obviously that worked well. But then scaling this up and out of a sudden talking to real customers, solving their real needs, it's a different ballgame. So how does that look for you?
Of course, because then, especially, I think what was really important for us is that in the lab, you usually work with very specific molecules. It's not like the kind of waste that you will find in the industry that always have some contaminations, suddenly some heavy metals or some halogens, whatever, that will be very corrosive for your equipment. So I think, and I'm very happy that we started this quite enough, because eventually our solution is something to be sold to like big companies. And with big companies as a startup, it's always very difficult to build relationship, to be credible, and eventually to have them pay for your solution. So we really started by contacting companies, explaining our technology, and trying to understand their challenge and the characteristics of their waste. And that's how we started. And we did a little bit of service with that, which was great because we could generate a little bit of revenue as well. But we had really like several companies sending us 10, 20 kilogram of their waste that we would process in our small prototypes, and say like, okay, this is the quality of the process water, this is how much gas we can generate, this would be the idea in terms of CapEx, OpEx for you, and okay, how does it look?
Right.
And yeah, we saw that for some waste streams, sometimes it's not competitive enough, for some others it's very competitive. And that's a little bit how the thing started. And we also went from the municipal sewer sludge, that was really our benchmark. That's really what we used to develop the technology. It's a very tricky feedstock in terms of, yeah, technically speaking, it's a complex feedstock. And that's where we opened a little bit and say, okay, now if it works with a very complex feedstock, it has to work as well for like other kind of waste.
Yeah.
And that's where we go. We went to the industry. The food and beverage, the oil and gas, the chemical, the pharma sector, that are usually the kind of factors that have like very strict regulations in terms of waste. And yeah, I think our process is suitable for them, and is a good alternative to the incineration that they need to deal with today.
Yeah. And how is the feedback in general from your industry partners? Because what we often see working with climate tech companies is sort of, you try to push a new solution into the market. And we stated before, right? Yours doesn't even have that green premium. So if you say, look, it's compatible or cheaper than the solution that you have now, it allows you to reuse, materials, has water that you would otherwise pay for again in the waste stream, and you would have to pay for the incineration as well. So sort of there are multiple layers of benefits, and still I would argue that there's often a resistance to change, or sort of that openness to trying out a new solution. So how does that look for you? What's the feedback been?
Especially in the waste sector, because the waste sector is just a few companies in the world. So innovation, etc., it's something that of course they want to keep an eye on, but they are not the most bullish, because if there is among 20 people, there is one guy that needs to take the first step and take the risk. It's a bit more complex than if you arrive in an industry where the big players are like thousands or millions. So yeah, waste is a very specific sector. But I think before that, what is important is that since our technology can, okay, deal with waste, but more importantly, produce renewable gas, this is really how the things took off, because we've been supported by energy companies, the people that understood that in the future, it's very unlikely that natural gas will still flow in their grids, and they need to find some other kind of technologies that will allow them to, you know, basically to keep their business, because they make money by transporting natural gas or biomethane in their pipes.
And they also have those decarbonization goals as well, right? Which you know, natural gas for a long time has been sort of seen as a solution, obviously being out of the fossil fuels the cleanest. But you're absolutely right that, you know, that business model will also come to an end at one point. So that's a really interesting observation that your approach allows them to continue to operate.
So the energy aspect was indeed very important. It's really the first big companies that supported the technology that started to move a little bit in this specific worlds. But sometimes...
Has that sentiment also changed after Russia invaded Ukraine? Like, has that element of
course,
energy security become even more important? Because I would assume from the start, that wasn't the focus of your technology, yeah. Right? The focus was sort of on treating the waste in a better way. And then, you know, the gas and renewable gas was a nice byproduct. But I would almost assume that completely turned upside down, that was the focus, and well, the application is
you're absolutely right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. So we started our first seed series with external investors at the end of 2021, and then, you know, suddenly this conflict happens between Ukraine and Russia, and you can see like everyone in Europe panicking about seeing the price of natural gas rising, etc. And at this moment, I was pitching the circularity of our solution. Like, you know, you can produce fertilizer, water, renewable gas, etc., on these public sectors with sewage sludge, etc. And at this moment, we really had to, we totally changed our pitch and said, like, okay, this technology is actually a weapon for governments that will allow them to generate local gas, because today there is so much waste that is exported or not properly valorized. And actually, we need to consume energy to dispose it. But tomorrow we can actually generate local renewable gas. And I think this is really what attracted our first investors, mostly from the energy and the biogas and energy sector. So that was important. But then for these guys, sometimes it's a bit tricky to understand that to have a economically viable solution, waste is important. Waste is our input. We cannot just say, oh, we're going to make millions by producing renewable gas, because you have a cost to produce this megawatt hour of gas. And if you have a client that is willing to pay you to dispose this waste at the same time, then it's double benefit, because you generate money by treating a waste, but also by selling byproducts. And so I think that's a little bit one of the challenges in the clean tech, is that for us, we are not only about water, we are not only about waste, we're not only about renewable energy, we are a little bit of all of this, you know. Which sometimes, especially for investors, they want you to fit in a box, a very specific box. And sometimes it's a bit complex to like highlight all these different USPs. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. I think sort of what you need is sort of that narrative that's easy to understand, where you fit you in, right? Like, and you're right that you're, what I've learned today, I from the outside have seen you also as a, and you heard the intro, as a waste treatment company with the additional byproducts, right? But what I've learned today is, well, all those parts are equally important. We also discussed the importance of water, which wasn't obvious. I mean, obviously, I know how incredibly important clean water is and access to water is, but it wasn't as apparent to me before this conversation how, you know, how much you benefit or how much could you contribute to that as well. So I think that's really important to create and own a narrative that allows you to really tick those boxes fast, or even potentially create your own box. And yeah, you have it slightly harder that you're not just an energy company, not just a waste treatment company, not just a clean water company, but, well, thankfully then also you tick all of them. And I think what's really exciting is also that, as you just shared, that your business model has sort of those potential upsides on various streams, right? It's sort of you're being paid to treat the waste, but you're also being paid to deliver that energy afterwards.
Absolutely.
And that's really nice.
Yeah. And this we really understood also with the, so among our investors during the seed series in 2023, really at the end, we met with this Saudi Arabian company, a petrochemical company, and they really brought the challenge about water, because they are really in a country where the Royal Commission is pushing for these guys to become more autonomous in terms of water. Water has a big impact. It's like fully desalinated at first. Then the oil and gas is actually using a lot of water, generating a lot of wastewater. But they have so much energy that it's easy for them to just burn this water, which again ends up as steam in the atmosphere and is absolutely lost. So this shareholder, but also early adopter, is it was really the first time we understood about the value of water and the value of being able to deliver clean water. There is, maybe you've heard of the big challenge humanity is facing today with PFAS and micropollutants, ethanol pollutants. So this is the kind of things that I know there are many solutions for that, but our technology can also deal with PFAS concentrates that unfortunately today only very high temperature incineration can eliminate these things. And PFAS is everywhere. So we need to make sure that whatever we treat, we are able to eliminate all these kind of nasty micropollutants.
Yeah, that's really powerful. And as you just shared your progress, so how, if you had to summarize the journey from, starting in the basement, well, actually starting even before, to realizing that the PhD was not for you, and then going to the basement, staying in university, doing the prototyping, and then, raising seed rounds and so on. How far have you come on your journey, would you say?
It's a good question. I think we always think, and you do your projections and your financials and your roadmap, etc. And yeah, it always takes more time. It's always more expensive than you thought, and you always think, oh, maybe tomorrow we're gonna be like done with our main mission. But
yeah, so I think next big thing always comes up, huh?
Yeah, exactly. No, I think we had a very nice journey. I mean, we learned so much, and also, for startups, timing is so important. I remember I had some pitching sessions a few years ago, and I think it was during this war crisis with the energy price being extremely high, and I had some questions from the audience, people saying, oh, but what you're telling me about too beautiful to be true, like, why are you still with your small pilots, and why are you like with hundreds of factories around the world?
See, I would have asked a similar question. So yeah, I'm looking forward to the answer.
So well, it's funny, because the concept of this technology is actually more than 100 years old. And it's funny to see how, suddenly, depending on the needs of humankind, basically, things are just like coming from interesting to uninterested. So the Nazi during World War II didn't have much oil. So they did this pyrolysis, converting waste into like this oil for their tanks and whatever. And then suddenly, when we realized there is oil a bit everywhere during the 70s, then this kind of technology was totally dropped. Now we are back to this kind of things. And it's a little bit the same for our technology. That's obviously something quite complex. It needs, we knew that it was not a 2 years adventure. We knew that we were going for a long marathon, and going from TRL 2-3 to TRL 9 with such things, it takes really a lot of time and requires a lot of capex. But I think if we would have had the maturity we have today 10 or 15 years ago, I don't think we would have been successful, you know. So yeah, timing is very important. That's the case for a lot of startups.
Right, because what you're saying is you would have been too early because the market would have not been ready and open to your solution. And now, the given... Okay, yeah, really good point. But to reframe that question then again,
yes,
the ambition is that, you know, your technology is everywhere, right? Or do you sort of see that? How do you see that?
Of course. So that's also one of our main motivation is that we are not just developing something that will be useful for Switzerland or Europe or the US, whatever. It's really something that can benefit to the world, to many industries.
I like that really what you mentioned before. Waste is more or less, waste is everywhere, right? Like each municipality has waste streams. And so basically you could be everywhere.
We could be everywhere. Of course, a lot of industrial process will evolve. The waste will change. When it comes to humans, we are not about to stop going to the restroom. So this kind of waste will always remain. What will change is that sewage will be more centralized in the future. And there are still some countries where only a few percentage of the population is connected to the sewage. And this should increase, hopefully, thanks to regulation. So I think that's really, again, one of the things that is really exciting about our business and our mission is that we could really serve people in all kind of countries. But then, of course, we need to start with those that have like strict regulations.
Yeah, and where it's easiest for you to implement those projects in order to show the rest of the world that they can make that investment, right? It goes back to what we discussed before, sort of that ability to move and that openness to innovation.
Exactly.
If we're to have that conversation in 3 to 5 years again, you know, if you could paint the picture, could wish for a future of your liking, what would you say? What will you have achieved by then?
3 to 5 brings us to 2030. So
yeah, 2030. Yeah, let's take 2030.
So yeah, because we need a lot of time. So I think 5 years is good projection. You know, by then we need to do another fundraising, so a Series A, which that's part of life. It's not the most exciting topic, but it's something that we need
well,
to.
Well, I find it super exciting.
I think what is exciting is to if you have this luxury of being able to choose your investors, and this really opens you like. How much strategic is this money for you? Like, are they these kind of people? You know, with my actual investors, I can do a lot of R&D. I can work on like an early adopter project and these kind of things. And for the future one, of course, we would like to have the possibility to have people that will open some new doors for us, some either technically or in terms of feedstocks or clients or et cetera, maybe other markets from in the geographic areas. So that's clearly something we need to do. That's more on the short term. So in the next year or so. And, you know, today we have our first industrial pilot. So we have commissioned at the end of last year, a demonstration unit that is installed at our first client close to our place in Switzerland. So these things obviously still need some optimization. We have a couple of, you know, other like average size project in the pipeline, but by 2030, and that's we need to be ambitious, and it depends a lot on the business model. Do we go with licensing? Do we go with an OEM sale? Do we want to do service, etc.? But the idea for us is clearly to have a mature technology, dozens of units hopefully installed around the world, having our break even, of course, and working a little bit more on like penetrating new markets, penetrating new sectors. That's the kind of things that would be great to have in the next 5 years.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed that all of that comes true for you. And maybe this brings us home to sort of my last question, because it's been quite a journey since you, well, had the first idea around TradeTech and founded TradeTech, for more than I guess a decade now than ago. What is it that keeps you going? Because it's sort of, if you look back at all those years, and I think that was also what the question in the audience that you described before pointed towards too, you could say, look, these guys have come quite far. There's d industrial demonstrators in the field, but then again, for a company that's 12 years or more than a decade old, if you look at the AI companies, they change the world overnight nowadays, and like. And I know it's obviously different volumes and what you're doing is completely different, but sort of from the scale of what they're building, if you look at the likes of Lovable to give an example, they're at 100 million ARR within 6 months, which is crazy and super happy for them, but that's not where we are, and that's not our space. So there must be something that keeps you going in order to continue that journey in the time frame that you just described until 2030, it's another 5 years. So what is it that you have in you that says I'm going to continue on that marathon?
It's a good question, and I like your parallel with AI, because there was this period when blockchain and crypto started, and now it's AI,
Yeah,
and
true.
I think that's fascinating technologies. It's really something that's we need AI. I mean, we need to also use this for our process and a lot of things like predictive maintenance and stuff like that. But for me, these kind of things that are going so quickly, you need to be so much at the right time at the right moment, and
It goes back to the
I
timing question that you said before, right? Like you need to be
exactly.
there. You can't be too early and you can't be too
And
late.
there is a lot of competition. Like you cannot believe you are the only one in Europe. You know that some people in US are already on that, some people in China or other places in the world. So I think the competition is huge, and I think that's not really something for me. As you said, I have a lot of respect and I love what these guys are doing. But I knew by starting these things that we would really go for like a big marathon. So everything takes more time. Everything is requires more money. But so you struggle a lot. You suffer. Sometimes things don't work as it should or as you expected. So it's difficult moments, but sometimes you just have like this tiny reward, that's it can be nothing, just a phone call with someone that tells you like, oh, that's beautiful, that's exactly what I need. Or I don't know, these small things that are like very big reward and that can really makes you like forget about all the rest and do another step and focus on your work for the next again 2 to 3 months. So it's to answer your question, it's for me, it's really it's about different things. It's like I need to know why I do what I do, and of course you don't have better than a startup for that. Okay, there is a lot of ungrateful things about startup, but at least we have this. We know why we do things, and today we have a team of around 15 people, and I think all of them know in their specific task, daily task, what is the connection with the main strategy of the company. So yeah, for me that's super important to have this every morning to wake up and make sure that I'm still excited about doing this. I think it's also a lot about people. You have a team, you're responsible for these people, you're responsible for them to provide to their families. For me, it's very important. It's extremely I feel very grateful to have this kind of responsibilities that are of course sometimes complicated, but for me it's not only about us or the founders or the shareholders. It's really about the people and having them. You need to make sure that if you are really ready for this marathon, that the guys that will jump in this train will also be ready for this marathon. It doesn't work always perfectly, and some people are tired a bit before others, but at some point you know that you have your fellows around, and and everyone is pulling on the same rope, and that's really cool thing. So in startups, I would say it's like very flat for sometimes, and sometimes some low, but there is just like some peaks, you know, some very peaks that makes like everyone very eager to continue and to give all their energy to deliver this this solution.
Yeah, really good observations. And I think what it boils down to for me, from what I heard from you, is sort of having a strong why. You know, that's super crucial, that everyone is mission aligned and know how their work contributes to the overall vision of the company and how to get there. And, you know, we went through these through this why quite a bit on today's recording. And I think the other part is also knowing that it is going to be a marathon is an important aspect in it, that you don't expect, like, you know, other tech areas to scale immediately. You know, you just described this as it might be low for some time, and, you know, going into a fundraising, looking at sort of at probably revenue projections and so on. Like those, especially in hardware climate tech, they are often very stable slash low for quite some time until sort of it hits off, right? And I think that's the exciting part, knowing that it does come. You do see the validation from the market. There is the demand. You obviously had the right timing, have the right timing for your solution. And now it's just really also about execution, which is a different ballgame from before, where it was about proving that it works. Now it's more about, well, bringing it to market. Different set of challenges, but not less exciting. So that's a good reason to get up, at least for the next 5 years. And then afterwards.
It's a good point. It's like having just like a client that you took time with, you understood their constraints, their challenges, and then, you know, finally they understand about what you can deliver, and just seeing them enthusiastic about it. You never know if it's the same person, the same human that you're going to sell the final solution in 2-3 years by now. But just having this kind of confirmation is beautiful. We had some visits of our pilot units from different people, stakeholders, or investors, and some of them saw like the very small prototypes. And when they see like finally something that looks more like a small factory, you know, they are like they are proud, and they see that we have used their money correctly and in a good way. And just seeing this is for us, it's really a big reward. Yeah.
Yep, rightfully so. Well, that was a very uplifting end. I like that. You know, sometimes work in climate tech can be, you know, all doom and gloom. So I like that we ended on a very high note, using investors' money correctly and scaling from, you know, small scale to small factory. That's a good note to end us on. So thank you so much for your time and energy today, and all the insights. Really enjoyed it, and looking forward to following your progress.
Thank you.